This is NPR News. I'm Tom Weber. You've been hearing all month here on the show from an idea that we had that I stole from the Canadians about Indigenous Book Club Month. We've been interviewing Indigenous authors from Minnesota and elsewhere all month. The month is at an end, and we're going to add one more interview to this collection here on the podcast. So you're getting some bonus material if you listen to the podcast. A significant chapter, this is what we're going to talk about here. There's a significant chapter in the history of Native American rights in this country that started in Minneapolis in 1968 with an organization called the American Indian Movement. The history of AIM includes protests, occupations of buildings, and calls for more equity and equality for American Indians. A few years ago, there was a pictorial history of AIM written in a book by Laura Waterman Whitstock. It also included decades of photos from Dick Bancroft. And the book is called We Are Still Here, and Laura Waterman Whitstock joins me now. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
For someone who has never heard of AIM, give me the brief history.
Well, you know, 1968 was a period of general revolt against the Vietnam War. There were several organizations that emerged to look at their own populations and the issues in their own population. So you had Chicano with race, and you had the Black Panthers in the African-American community. There were even groups of Asians in San Francisco, where there's large Chinese population and other Asian populations that were organizing, not as well known, in Minneapolis, where a very large number of Indians had relocated from the 11 reservations in the state. There was considerable, I wouldn't say unrest, but there was considerable concern. There were a lot of Indian people going to college. There were a lot of people in jobs in the region, and yet the question remained, why don't we follow the treaties? Why don't we recognize the sovereignty of Indian nations? Why are Indians at the bottom of the economic scale? And so a small group of Indians interested in education, economic development, and civil rights organized and formed the American Indian Movement.
Yeah. And so you're talking about, so clearly in 1968, a tumultuous year, yes, you had the anti-war protests, but you're talking about a second chapter of groups that are being, you're talking about the Asian Americans, for example, in San Francisco, less about the war, although that's in there, and more about just equity and equality.
It really followed on Board v. Education, the Supreme Court decision, and people were pressing for educational equality. One of the AIM founders, George Mitchell, who had just come out of the Marines, organized a little class for Indian teens in the basement of a building in North Minneapolis. Hmm. That's how determined they were to bring Indian children up to a level equal to other people.
Now, you mentioned Minneapolis, an important urban American Indian population here. And that was the result of another government actual program, relocation. I mean, the theory behind this was if you have these far-off rural reservations, we should get some of those people into more urban centers where there's more jobs and more opportunities, and that will help them. All in all, how did that work out?
Well, that is the nice side
of
the story.
Right, exactly. That's the bumper sticker, right?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
The bad part of that story is that, like taking puppies far away from their home, you expect that they'll never come back. The idea behind relocation was take them to far-off cities, they'll put down roots, and they won't come back to the reservation, therefore lessening the financial burden of the U.S. government. the relocation did not include the city of Minneapolis until very late into the program. People were coming on their own after World War II because they wanted economic security and better education for their children.
As we think about then AIM, I mean, you're talking about events, you know, protests and occupations very much in the news in their day. Again, for people who don't know the history very much, what are those occupations and those protests that stand out in the history?
Well, I think locally, one of the first ones was the occupation of the Naval Air Station near the airport in the greater Minneapolis area. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind that was that there were other events in Colorado and so forth, and it was to draw immediate attention. And once they got the attention of governmental authorities, they would press their demands. So that was the idea. It may sound a little odd today that you would go out and do that, but in 1968, we had this enormous population called baby boomers. And the population was booming in the Indian community as well. So you had large numbers of Indian people that were willing to congregate in areas. There were also Vietnam vets who were American Indians, and they readily joined this movement.
There were also sit-ins at the federal courthouse. Walter Mondale,
yes.
Who was a senator at the time, Walter Mondale's office. I think that was that in Washington or was that in Minneapolis?
Well, as a result of the Naval Air Station situation, and there were charges pressed, and so that resulted in the federal court photographs that you see that Dick Bancroft took that are in the book. Walter Mondale was interested, and he came out to the Naval Air Station to talk to the people to try to find out what the issue was, and the issue was education.
Clearly, I think for people who know the history, I think the event that stands out is Wounded Knee in 1973. It was a 71-day occupation out on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. A lot of opinions, one way and the other, on the importance of that occupation, but whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, for sure. Your reflections on Wounded Knee.
Well, this was the singular event that emanated from within a reservation. And it was the people within the reservation, some of them, who had joined an organization that called AIM and said, help us.
Help us with what? What was the...
Help us with our demand that the tribal chairman be unseated, basically. They felt that he was not running a tribal government, but he was running a mob. He had a group of more or less civilian militia that were riding around the reservation. There were allegations that their trailers and homes had been shot. It's a miracle that people weren't killed.
Yeah.
And so that was the sort of dire situation that mainly elders of the tribe were deeply concerned with. And they felt, looking over at Minnesota, they felt that this was the organization that could help them.
The occupation, it's so interesting to think of the efforts that AIM had against the U.S. federal government, the white man's government, but then this also was an action kind of intra, right? It was saying, look, this tribal government, again, a government set up, a structure set up, you know, by the white man for sure, but that this leader also had to go, so say that the demands. And so it wasn't just AIM going against the government, although the image of Wounded Knee is the Indian community against the federal marshals and the FBI and the like.
Well, you know, when houses get shot up, the authority that the police authority that is supposed to investigate is the Federal Bureau of Investigation. They were not present on the reservation to an extent that they were actually investigating these allegations. So AIM sort of took their place, and it was the FBI then that prosecuted AIM in the famous trials that took place in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the attorneys included William Kunstler, a very famous attorney out of New York City.
And you had impressions, at least some of the news reports I saw from the time, you can find them on YouTube and the like. I mean, they would interview people who say AIM is nothing but a bunch of outsiders coming in and messing this up and making a terrible thing here. Was that accurate?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is that the there were these voices, and a lot of them were coming from government sources. And interestingly, the main media, New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, were picking this up and characterizing AIM as, quote, militants, as usurpers, as people vigilantes, people taking the law into their own hands, and all of that. And it was the American Indian Press Association at the time that had one person out of a, you know, three-person staff that went out and reported on Wounded Knee for the American Indian public. So there was this difficulty in trying to wrest what is the truth in this matter? What are we looking at?
Yeah.
And you could not rely on secondary sources because they seemed to be picking up what the government was saying.
What was your role during this time? What were you doing?
Well, one of our reporters went out to Wounded Knee. It was not me, but there was also the takeover of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which occurred just prior to Wounded Knee. And I was the reporter that was in there for
for the Native American
Press Association.
Yeah.
And it got pretty randy after about 9 days of being in the building with no water.
My goodness. How was and is to this day the American Indian movement perceived within the American Indian community?
I think there is still a great divide. There has always been a negative view of the American Indian movement in generally Indian people who work for the government, whether that's tribal government, local government, state government, or federal government, because it's seen in the same light that you see the Black Panthers, disorganized militants in terms of they carry arms, hair trigger personalities, and people who want to get in front of the cameras of the media. On the other side, you have a great number of elders, people who speak their own language, people who have lived in their communities for 50, 60 years, come out from the Navajo Nation, from the other nations, and walked hundreds of miles. Why? To press the charge that Indian people are still here.
What's the legacy of AIM?
Well, one of the things AIM has done is to create a museum. And the exhibit going on right now is on the survival schools. It started the schools, it ran the schools, and they were successful for decades. And education is still an issue with AIM and will always be until every child has a decent chance to an education.
And these are answers also to the boarding school history, right? The horrible history of killing the Indian, not the child. You know, and sending them off to far places. So AIM comes along and says, let's just have our own schools that we run.
It was primarily an answer to public school education, but many of the people who joined AIM came from the boarding schools. Yeah. They had experienced firsthand what it was like to have their hair forcibly cut. And I believe it may not be in the book, but there are some poignant pictures of a child before boarding school and after boarding school. And not hundreds of years ago, but in the 1960s.
Yeah, people who don't remember, people who are alive today who went to boarding school.
Oh, absolutely. And, yeah. and the general public is unaware of the cruelty of the boarding school that, you know, pushed right up into the 70s until the light came on. And now we are seeing in Canada and in the United States all of these reparations right. that have to occur.
And these tribunals set up to offer reconciliation. That's what they're called, the reconciliation
yes.
panels.
Yes.
This book, We Are Still Here, is actually a photographic history as well of the American Indian Movement, and Dick Bancroft took those photos. He's not here today. He's got some health issues, but as we think about it, and I know you have the book there in front of you, but when you think of the photos as you've leafed through this book in your life, which ones stand out for you? What are the potent stories and photos that mean so much to you here in this book?
Well, there's one of the defenders of the BIA building sitting out in the front, and they're sitting as if they were at a powwow. They have a folding chair, and one on page 49,
yeah, I see
and
that.
One man is wrapped in a flag, and they are carrying staffs, such as you would have for a flag. But if you look down, the staff has three, is a tripod, mm-hmm. and is either sound equipment or something else, obviously appropriated from inside the building. But it's a fabulous photograph of the iconic image of Indian people that takes your breath away. Mm-hmm. And then, and I don't know what page it's on exactly, but there's a picture of Russell Means without a shirt.
Mm-hmm. The late Russell Means.
The late Russell Means. And he is coming across a field with a young woman, and he is smiling, and you see his full personality. Many of the photos of Russell Means are serious, and you know, he's mm-hmm. he's sort of scowling almost. But this is a moment when he's very happy. And I think that is significant.
The book is called We Are Still Here. It came out a few years ago from the Minnesota Historical Society Press. Laura Waterman Whitstock, who was a journalist during the crux and the main years of the American Indian Movement, wrote the text. Dick Bancroft did the photographs. And I'm so glad you were here today to talk about this. Thanks so much.
Thank you.